The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm John Hinderacher from Powerline, filling in for Seth today. And I will be back with you tomorrow and Friday as well. I guest hosted the show yesterday, and we spent almost the entire program talking about the Democrats' impeachment efforts. Of course, it was in the news. There was news about this panel of law professors that's going to testify to something, who knows what. Tomorrow and other things in the offing. But we spent almost the entire show talking about impeachment. And so in an act of penance, I have declared today impeachment-free Tuesday. We are not talking about impeachment today. We're talking only about other topics. And if you want to weigh in on any of the things we're talking about, give us a call. The number is 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. So I want to spend some time this hour talking about foreign policy. I think sometimes foreign policy gets short shrift on the radio and in the newspapers and on television, just about everywhere until there's a real disaster in the news. And I think there's a really interesting news story right now that illustrates some basic points about the Trump administration. Do you remember when Donald Trump was running for the presidency in 2016? He was critical of NATO, and his enemies, his opponents, the Democrats, the press, tried to pretend that Trump was threatening to pull out of NATO, that Trump was, you know, going to undermine the transatlantic alliance, blah blah blah. But that was never what he was talking about. What Trump was talking about was that this was a number of instances in international affairs where the United States was being taken advantage of, where prior presidents had not adequately stood up for America, put America first. And as a result, we were not faring the way we should have when it came to supporting NATO. And Trump's complaint was that the United States was bearing way too much of the cost, way too much of the burden, and our allies, including our rich allies, our wealthy allies, England, Germany, France, you know, these people got plenty of money, and they were not adequately supporting their own defense. And NATO, of course, is an artifact of the post-World War II world, and there was a time when every country in Europe had been bombed, and the United States was standing alone with a strong economy, but those days are gone. Europe is prosperous and ought to be doing a better job of paying its own defense costs. And that was the point that Donald Trump was making in the campaign. He was right. He was completely right. And since he's been president, he has been pushing for other NATO countries to do a better job of paying their own defense obligations. So this is the story now from the Tennessee Star. As Britain prepares for the NATO leaders' meeting outside London, December 3 and 4, it's going on right now, the alliance said Thursday it had agreed to redistribute costs and cut the U.S. contribution to its central budget. Now, the NATO central budget is about $2.5 billion a year. It basically covers headquarters operations and staff and so forth. That's different from the defense budget. And the article goes on, U.S. President Donald Trump often complains of inequitable burden sharing, with only 9 of the 29 member countries meeting the 2% of gross domestic product target for defense spending. Now, so there's two things going on here. First of all, regarding the central budget of about $2.5 billion a year, NATO's Secretary General is a guy named Jens Stoltenberg, announced that going forward, the U.S. is going to pay less and Germany is going to pay more. So now the U.S. and Germany will pay equal contributions toward NATO's central budget. Beginning in 2021, next year, both the U.S. and Germany will contribute about 16% of that $2.5 billion. Currently, we're paying 22%. But starting next year, our contribution drops from 22% to 16%, and Germany's rises to equal ours at 16%. So that's good. You know, this is the kind of thing that an American president should do. He should be standing up for the United States, representing us, not only when dealing with our enemies, but also in dealing with our friends. We shouldn't be taken advantage of. So that's the central budget, which is the relatively small part of what we're talking about. But still, I'll continue here. This is from the article in the Tennessee Star. It says, the announcement to reduce the American contribution is seen as a move to placate Trump. Well, yeah, that's right. It's a move to placate Trump because he's the one that's been complaining about the United States paying more than our fair share. The other part of this that's really more important because the dollars are so much bigger is contributing a reasonable amount toward your own defense. And here we're going to quote from a senior administration official who was quoted on Friday. In 2016, only four allies spent 2% of GDP on defense. So that's the target. NATO members are supposed to spend 2% of their gross domestic product on defense. But when President Trump took office, there were only four members of the organization who were actually meeting that target. There are now, 3 years later, there are nine countries rather than four, including the U.S., that are meeting the 2% target. So it's gone from four countries to nine countries, and 18 NATO members are expected to meet the 2% goal by 2024. So we're going from four countries meeting that goal. Now there are nine countries expected to be 18 NATO members by 2024. And the spokesman says, quote, this is tremendous progress, and I think it is due to the president's diplomatic work, unquote. Well, of course it is. Of course it is. Barack Obama didn't stand up for America. Barack Obama didn't complain that we were paying more than our fair share of defense costs. Now, he wanted to cut our defense budget, but that's doing it the wrong way. The smart way to do it is by getting our allies to contribute more toward their own defense through the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And I think that is a great example of how President Trump has stood up for the United States. And his opponents, his political opponents, when he talks about putting America first, you know, they try to make that into a sinister slogan, like it's fascist or something, harkening back to the 1930s when there was a movement called America First. Totally different, totally unrelated, irrelevant. And what Trump has always, he's always been very clear about what he means when he talks about putting America first. And that is, as president of the United States, his job is to serve the American people, not to serve the British. We like the British. But as president, he's not their president, he's our president. And his job is to put America first, to represent the citizens of the United States of America, both when dealing with our friends and when dealing with our enemies. And I think the fact that he's now got NATO allies doing a much better job of contributing to their own defense is a great example of what it means to put America first when you're the president of the United States. So that's one foreign policy story that I think is really worth focusing on and paying attention to. We're seeing the same thing in trade. You know, it's not that Trump loves tariffs. It's not that Trump wants to bring international trade to a halt or and so forth, as his critics allege. But again, as he's made perfectly clear, starting when he was running for president in 2015 and 2016, Trump believes that the United States in prior administrations has entered into a number of trade agreements that were not very favorable to the U.S., maybe favorable to other countries like China, but not very favorable to the U.S. And his point is not that he wants to end international trade or he wants to return to the Smoot-Hawley days of the 1930s, as some of his critics have charged. That's not the point at all. The point is that he wants the United States not to be taken advantage of. He wants the United States to be operating on a level playing field under fair trade agreements. And he's done, I think, a terrific job of trying to make that happen. We're seeing that play out right now in the tough negotiations he's got going on with the Chinese. I talked about this a little bit earlier with John Dombrowski, the financial planner. I mean, it's obvious that the Chinese are looking at the newspaper headlines, watching the impeachment proceedings, and thinking, well, maybe we can wait this out. Maybe we don't have to make a final deal with President Trump, because if we get lucky, a Democrat might win in 2020. And that's part of the dynamic of the trade negotiations with the Chinese. Well, let's hope that President Trump is able to make a good deal with the Chinese, and let's hope he's able to do it in his first term rather than his second term. We're going to run to a break, and we'll be back with more on the Seth Leibson Show. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm John Hinderacher from Powerline, filling in for Seth today on Impeachment-Free Tuesday. We'll talk about anything under the sun except the Democrats' impeachment farce. If you want to weigh in on anything we're talking about or raise something brand new, that's okay, too. Just give us a call. The number is 602-508-0960. This hour, we're spending some time talking about what's happening abroad. I think sometimes we get so caught up in domestic issues that that we don't pay as much attention as we might to foreign policy and more generally to what's happening around the world. And I want to talk a little bit about the story out of the United Kingdom that I'm sure you're aware of and you've seen the news reports on. And that was the terrorist attack that took place at Fishmongers Hall, which is right adjacent to London Bridge. And a guy named Usman Khan was actually a participant in a prison reform program that was being put on at Fishmongers Hall. It's kind of a public forum there. And apparently in the middle of this program, which he was a participant in, he pulled out a couple of big, long, kind of machete-style knives and started attacking people. And he killed two people, a man and a woman. He wounded a number of others. And then he started running. He ran onto London Bridge. And several people who had been in the meeting or maybe were just walking by outside, I'm not certain, chased him. And they chased him down on London Bridge. And one of these guys, I mean, this is just great. You can't make this stuff up. One of these guys grabbed a fire extinguisher, I think from Fishmongers Hall. And he started spraying this terrorist, Usman Khan, with the fire extinguisher. And another guy, there were three or four who ran this terrorist down on the bridge. Another guy grabbed a narwhal tusk off the wall of the Fishmongers Hall. And chased after the terrorist using this narwhal tusk as a weapon. Now, if you think back to what a narwhal is, it is this weird, I don't know if it's a whale or, I mean, it's some kind of marine creature. And it's got a single long tusk that grows like out of its nose. And it's, I don't know, 8 feet long, maybe something like that. Obviously varies, but, you know, 6, 8 feet long. And it's kind of got a spiral to it. It's a really strange and interesting anatomical feature. And some people think that this is the genesis of the myth of the unicorn, because every once in a while in ancient times, a narwhal tusk might wash up on the shore, for example, and somebody might find it and think, wow, what is this? It belongs to some bizarre creature with one horn. And maybe that's where the unicorn came from. Anyway, one of these people who had been participating in this program, this event at Fishmongers Hall, picked up off the wall where it was mounted a narwhal tusk, and he along with some other guys chased the terrorist. They caught up with him on London Bridge. One guy is whacking him with the narwhal tusk. Another guy is spraying him with the fire extinguisher. Another guy tackles him to the ground. And these three guys, one of them steps on one of his hands and forces him to release this big knife that he's holding. They disarm him. And at that moment, several armed policemen come running up to the scene, and they wave these civilians who had tackled the terrorist away, tell them to get out of the way. The terrorist was wearing a suicide belt, an apparent suicide belt, although it turned out to be a fake. But the police didn't know that at the time. And the civilians who pursued this guy, they didn't know it either. I mean, it looks like he's wearing a suicide belt. So it was an act of real courage for these guys to chase after the terrorist and confront him and attack him, tackle him, bring him down, disarm him. Anyway, the police arrive. They pull their firearms. They wave the civilians out of the way, and they waste no time. They're taking no chances because as far as they know, this is a live suicide belt. The guy could detonate it at any moment and kill a bunch of people. So they open fire. They shoot him. So that was the end of the episode. This terrorist turned out to be a guy named Usman Khan. But there's some interesting aftermath to this event. And it turns out that Usman Khan was a known terrorist. He was one of nine men who were arrested, I think it was in 2010, and imprisoned. I think they were sentenced not until 2012. But there were nine jihadists, and they were arrested for plotting to blow up the London Stock Exchange. They also were recorded, and there was documentary evidence that they were contemplating Mumbai-style terrorist attacks, that is, terrorist attacks where they just basically use guns and start shooting people like happened that time in Mumbai, India. And one of the plotters had a hit list that included the names and addresses of the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, of Boris Johnson, who at the time was the mayor of London, of two rabbis, because you can't go on a murder spree without killing some Jews, right, and the U.S. Embassy in London. And so these nine men were all sentenced to long prison terms in 2012, including this Usman Khan. Well, it turns out that Usman Khan only served half of his prison term, and he was let out in December of last year. So he was free for less than a year before he carried out his next terrorist attack, killing two people and wounding a number of others. So the non-mainstream newspapers in the UK investigated. You know, the respectable papers didn't do this, but the Sun and the Daily Mail started investigating to find out, well, what happened to these nine jihadists who were sentenced to long prison terms in 2012? Well, it turned out that of the nine, only two of them are still in jail. The remaining six, like Usman Khan, were released or have already been released. And their whereabouts, at least as of a couple of days ago, were unknown. So these nine guys sentenced to long terms, seven of them are now already back on the streets, and one of them has committed a new terrorist attack that ended with his own shooting by police. And there's a further irony here, because this guy, Usman Khan, was considered to be a model reformed criminal, a model reformed prisoner. And one of his victims was a 25-year-old guy named Jack Merritt. And Jack Merritt, by all accounts, was just a terrific guy, wonderful young man. But he was a prison reformer, and he was a course coordinator for a Cambridge Criminology Department initiative called Learning Together, in which students in universities and prisoners learn alongside one another. And it was a program of this organization that was going on when the terrorist attack occurred. We'll have more on this after these commercial messages. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. We've been talking about foreign affairs this hour. Let's take a couple of calls. Let's go to Hal in Prescott on line one. Hal, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Hey, thank you for taking the call. I appreciate it. It's nice of you to substitute host while Seth is advising the president. and I think, you know, you've spoken about NATO and this this terrorist, and these things are really tied together because it shows cultural problems in our civilization in the West. And so and it shows that we're delusional. So if you I think the question to ask about the NATO funding, you know, with only nine countries paying 2% is, you know, with Putin looking at that, he's going to ask the question or perhaps make a statement. If they won't spend money, they will not spend blood. And therefore, he's not deterred. And the purpose of NATO, a defensive alliance, is deterrence of aggression. And so in what we've seen since Putin in Ukraine is this slow creeping aggression that people like Putin do to, in order to see what they can get away with. And he's gotten away with quite a bit.
Yeah, like Crimea, so, for example. Right.
Yeah, yes. Just, we're just going to go into Ukraine and we're going to take what we want. And, you know, so he is clearly not deterred in 2014 when that all started with, you know, Obama's threats of blankets and MREs and whatever non-lethal aid is.
Right.
And so,
well,
and
the Ukrainian president at the time said it's hard to win a war with blankets, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, you're warm, you know, while they're killing you. I don't see how that works. And the flip side of that is this terrorist attack of this guy who was at this, you know, we're making the psychotic murderers better through reforming them conference. And it demonstrates the same naivete. Is can you convince religious fanatics who want to blow up the stock exchange that their worldview is wrong? Is it possible to do that? And then you do it and you say, okay, you're better, and you let them out of prison. Well, what are they going to do? They're depraved, but they're not insane. They're going to tell you what you want to hear. Oh, I feel very reformed, sir.
Yeah, this guy, Usman Khan, wrote this sort of groveling letter about how he'd seen the light and now he wants to be a true Muslim, you know.
And then
they bought it hook, line, and sinker.
So what this demonstrates is kind of a loss of a concept of deterrence. You know, some people can only be deterred. Putin understands deterrence. He doesn't understand weakness. And if you don't have anything to deter him with, he will not be deterred. And
Hal,
so we need to increase. I
think every single thing you're saying is true. I think that history teaches us, if history teaches any lesson, it is this. If you want peace, prepare for war. And if you don't prepare for war, you're likely to get it. And how that lesson can be forgotten is beyond me. But the fact is, there's a lot of people out there who have forgotten it. Hal, I think your points are well taken, and I think that President Trump is serving our interests and Europe's interests actually doubly. Number one, he's reducing our financial burden, but number two, he's actually increasing the preparedness and making NATO look like and actually be a more meaningful alliance, and hopefully that will deter. Deter Putin. Let's go to John in Phoenix on line two. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you how refreshing you are not talking about impeachment. That's very important. But you've switched the program around. I find it very, very, very nice. And thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
I don't even know your name. What is your name?
John Hinderlocker.
John Hinderlocker. Okay, John. I look forward to hearing from you again because you run a very nice program.
Thank you very much. Anybody who wants to join in, give us a call, 602-508-0960. If you are holding, hold through the break, and we'll take calls after these messages. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. We've been talking foreign affairs, foreign policy this hour. If you want to join in, the number to call is 602-508-0960. Let's go to Mike in Phoenix on line three. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Enjoying the show. Great replacement
Thanks.
For Seth. Let me
Thank
say, I wanted to remind folks, you mentioned a little bit about terror. Your last caller talked about it, a little bit about terrorism, talked about how the people like Putin don't respect detente. They don't respect a peaceful approach. They take what they can. They continue to seize what they can, so you stop them. And the same thing is true with terrorism. I want to remind you of a couple of famous names throughout our history in the last 100 or so years, all of whom were terrorists of one sort or another. Lenin, Stalin, all served time in prison even before the Russian Revolution. And they were assassins and bombers. You know, Hitler was a terrorist and involved in terrorist activities before he went to jail for his beer hall pooch. Mussolini was involved in terrorist activities. These people do not change their stripes. They never change their stripes. World War I was started by terrorists, effectively, because the anarchists of the day were believers in terrorism. And terrorism is a mechanism to achieve a political goal. And those political goals are always and have always been for totalitarian control. Right now, you've got Muslim extremists that are involved in terrorism, and that's because they want totalitarian control of whatever they have set their eyes on. That's not going to change. And the British made a big mistake releasing these people because they said that they had renounced their terrorist activities or that they had had a renaissance in the thinking. It's simply false, and throughout history we can demonstrate that that's never happened, and it's not about to change.
Yeah, Mike, I think you're basically right. I would put it a little bit differently. I would say, how confident are you? You know, how much are you willing to risk on the assumption that some group of terrorists has been reformed? In this particular case, there were 9 convicted terrorists, and 7 of them they've already let out of jail. So apparently the British authorities were totally confident that they were going to go 7 for 7. You see what
There's
I mean?
There's no history. I would never wager it because there is no house favor.
Right.
100% of the time, these people continue to pursue their political objective.
Well, or look, I mean, maybe it's not 100%. I mean, maybe 2 of the 7 actually have reformed. I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. But my point is, you have to be really, really confident that you're batting 1,000 when you just let these people go. And as you point out, history tells us that that is not a good bet. If you want to join the program, give us a call at 602-508-0960. I want to just go back here for a couple of minutes to the story that we've been talking about and that some of these calls were about. And that's this terrorist incident that happened a few days ago in London. It started at the Fishmongers Hall, and there was actually a program going on there. It was being put on for a combination of university students and prisoners and released prisoners. And I'm going to quote here from the article in the Daily Mail talking about the fact that of these 9 terrorists who were convicted of conspiring to blow up the London Stock Exchange in 2012, 7 of the 9 have quietly been released from prison. Of course, there was no public announcement of this. The authorities don't say, oh, by the way, or we're letting these guys out. They just quietly release them in hopes that they have been rehabilitated. So this is from the Daily Mail. And the terrorist was named Usman Khan. According to the Learning Together schedule of the day, Khan began his terror spree during the storytelling and creative writing session. The 28-year-old attacker is understood to have been invited to share his experience of prison. So he was actually invited to be a presenter at this program that's being put on. And one of his victims was a guy named Jack Merritt. And he was a 25-year-old guy who ran this program at Cambridge University that brought together students and criminals as part of this kind of criminal justice reform effort. And the article in the Daily Mail goes on. It says, in a cruel irony, Mr. Merritt was killed at a criminology event by one of the convicts he was trying to rehabilitate, 28-year-old terrorist Usman Khan. Mr. Merritt, the victim, believed that Khan's apparent redemption was a powerful case study of how a life could be changed for the better. But it now appears his rehabilitation was a sham intended to hide his murderous intentions. And so this is a classic case of how optimism about the potential for human improvement and human reform got the better of the authorities, and the consequences were fatal, with two people being killed and a number more wounded by this terrorist. And this, of course, happened in Great Britain, but the same thing happens in the United States. I mean, we're going through a very similar phenomenon right now, where there's all this pressure for so-called criminal justice reform. And if you ask, well, criminal justice reform, what does that mean? Well, there's all kinds of, you know, talk, but what it really comes down to is letting people out of jail, you know, not having them serve their full sentences, but letting them out of prison. That's what, as a practical matter, is meant by criminal justice reform. And I think the Usman Khan case is just one of many that illustrate the point that if you want to be confident that a criminal is not going to wreak mayhem on the innocent people, the best way to be confident of that is by keeping him in prison. And that if you wholesale release thousands of people, thousands of convicted criminals from prison, it is predictable that some of them probably have reformed. How many? I have no idea what that percentage is. But you can be sure that a lot of them have not reformed and are going to be recidivists. And the price is going to be paid, not primarily by upper-income people who live in gated communities and donate money to the American Civil Liberties Union. They are not likely to be the victims of crime when these people get let out of prison. It's mostly going to be poorer people, lower-income people, minorities who are going to pay the price. And we're seeing something very similar in the United States to what led to that that tragedy, that criminal attack in London. We're going to go to some commercial messages, and if you want to get on the program after this break, call us at 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. We've got a short segment here to wrap up the hour. Let's go straight to the phone lines. David in Phoenix on line one. Welcome to the program.
John, thanks for sitting in for Seth and covering the show for us.
Hey, thank you.
Listen, there's something that I don't think we talk enough about, which is that there's a real distinction between terrorists and criminals in that terrorists are ideology driven. And so their aims and goals are about destroying, bringing down, or changing society. And that's different from a criminal who is doing something for his own benefit or profit within the society. And that's a problem that a lot of previous administrations, they mix up police work from military national security work, and they are and should be two very, very different things. So we can't create a rational policy about criminal justice reform or things like that if we're mixing those two things, where someone is ideologically driven against society or someone who is just being self-serving outside the rules of law.
David, you know, you make a really good point, I think. Experience tells us, I mean, there's been all kinds of studies done over the years of recidivism rates and so on, and they're pretty depressing. I mean, a lot of people, when they get out of jail, revert to crime. But I think you're absolutely right. I don't know if there's any statistical analysis that's been done here, but I know, for example, that studies have been done of terrorists who were released from Guantanamo Bay, and a huge number of them have gone back into the fight. You know, they've joined the Taliban in Afghanistan, or they've, you know, joined ISIS or whatever, and have gone back to terrorism. I think you're probably right that whatever the recidivism rate is among criminals, it's probably that much worse among terrorists, because, as you say, they're acting from a profound ideological motivation. And of course, the other thing about terrorists is that they're hard to deter, because frequently, I would say most of the time, they're prepared to die. I mean, frequently, their method of terrorism is the suicide belt, right? So how do you deter a guy who's planning on dying? you know, you really can't. What that means is you've got to identify them. You've got to spy on terrorist organizations. You've got to prevent terrorist attacks from being carried out. And when you capture these people, you got to lock them up because they can't be deterred. David, you make an excellent point. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Stephen Hayward.